Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach, KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that the opinions expressed on any public affairs show do not reflect those of KX93.5, its management, or the board of directors.
Bringing to you the voices, policies, and positions of trailblazers and leaders from Laguna Beach, Orange County, and all across the great state of California, you are listening to Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson on Laguna's own KX93.5 FM. Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. I'd like to welcome my guest today, State Senator and candidate for California's next Lieutenant Governor, Dr. Ed Hernandez. Thank you for being here, Senator.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here in Laguna Beach today.
Well, my pleasure. California is a state of immigrants, and we are a nation of immigrants in general. Like myself and countless others across our wonderful state, you're the grandson of immigrants. You grew up in a working-class family, and you worked your way through college. How did that upbringing influence you growing up? And how does that influence you as a legislator in California Senate?
Well, I mean, obviously, my grandfather came to this country from Mexico with a third grade education. My father was a high school graduate, but worked in a factory. And it was that culture and those upbringings that kind of, you know, instilled in me, number one, the values of working hard. But it was my parents in particular that really felt that they wanted me to be the first person to go to college. So being the first person to go to college, it was difficult. It was very, very difficult, especially coming from the background that I have. So to answer your question with regard to being a grandson of an immigrant, a son of a factory worker, what made it difficult, I had to do it the hard way. I did 3 years of community college because I was working close to full time. I did 3 years of Cal State Fullerton. I purposely chose the Cal State systems because it was less expensive than the UC systems. I chose Cal State Fullerton because it was going against traffic where I was living and I had to get to my job. But that all shaped who I am as an individual because I came from a working class community, went through community college, went to the Cal State system, and was able to not only get my bachelor's degree, become a doctor, and go back to the community I served in. So yes, it has totally shaped and influenced who I am as a not only a young adult, but now as a state senator as well.
I see that same story being repeated now. Mm-hmm. Not only is your story, it's funny as I'm listening to you because it's almost exactly the same. My grandparents came here. My father had a manufacturing factory in the garment industry. He was the first in his family to get a college degree. And then, of course, the second generation you look at, such as myself, you have people who pursue further higher education, get their doctorate, their law degree, and become so profoundly valuable in the fabric of our society. And I see the same thing in my college students at Saddleback. I see parents who barely speak English, and so even though they may have a skill set, they take a job to put a roof over their family's head, but their kids are busting their tails to get a college education. And like you said, you know, even something that may not occur to a lot of people, like, well, which college do I go to? Do I go to Fullerton or do I go elsewhere? Being able to get back and forth and get to work so that you can help support your family is an integral part of your decision-making process. And that goes on for more people than we often realize. For most people, education provides that access to the ladder of success and is essential to achieving the American dream. As Lieutenant Governor of California, you would serve on both the UC Board of Regents and on the Board of Trustees for the California State University System. We also see that there's such a high cost of getting a college education that frankly, it's making it financially inaccessible to far too many people. The days where a person can work a minimum wage job while they're going to college and pay their way through seems to have disappeared over the horizon. What should we be doing to help ensure that our best and brightest from every socioeconomic group are able to attain the education that will enable them to reach their full potential, and that California has the well-educated population it needs to remain the fifth largest economy in the world?
So let's follow up and talk about your experience that you said was very similar to mine. But more importantly, how so many kids in this state share those same experience, whether they're immigrant, whether they're working class, but more importantly, how you and I can relate because we come from those types of communities, okay? What we have to do in the state of California to make sure that we are not only economically viable, but economically advantaged where we can compete throughout the world is we have to educate our young adults. And I truly believe that we have a shrinking middle class in this country. We have a shrinking middle class and where we have a very small percentage of individuals with all the wealth. And it's getting more difficult, like you said, the cost of education, the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare. And the key to success is building that middle class through higher education, whether it's community colleges, whether it's career tech. You know, look at the building trades, becoming, you know, skilled workers. The CSU, system produces some of the most teachers in the state, nurses, the UC system become doctors. We really have to change that delta, and we have to do that at the highest level. And here's what we have to do. We have to address the master plan in the state of California. You made a comment about how inexpensive education used to be at one point. The master plan of the state of California states that if you're a California resident, your education is free. That's not the case. It continues to go up. We haven't addressed that in decades, and I believe that we need to have a much bigger and robust conversation, and I'm willing to have that as the lieutenant governor of the state of California, to work with the governor, to work with the legislature, because I have the experience and have been able to work with other legislators as well, but and also bring in other groups like community. We have to look at business and work in collaboration with business so that we can lower the cost of education for working class kids in the state of California.
If we had a policy, if we return to the policy that we had in California up until the early 1970s, where tuition for higher education was nearly non-existent, it was virtually free, if that policy were reinstituted, what would be some of the likely repercussions and what would be the benefits to our state?
Well, obviously the biggest benefit is getting kids who are having a tough time go through school, who can't afford it, have to work. But like I said, those middle-class students that don't apply, that apply but don't get accepted to their Cal Grants or, you know, educational opportunities, it is those kids that will help the most. But I think the biggest challenge we're going to have is how we're going to pay for it. And that's where we have to have that real conversation, number one, with the public. And we have to have that conversation with business because business has to be in partnership with our higher educational system to be able to make sure that there's collaboration and that we can control the costs of higher education.
I've heard a lot of people argue that if higher education were free and available to everyone, they wouldn't appreciate it. The people who receive that benefit would not appreciate it. Do you agree with that premise? But what would you think about the state and taxpayer funding for higher education requiring that students repay the system over time or perhaps repay the cost of their education by performing some type of public service?
So you had made a comment about how education used to cost decades ago. Yes, I agree. We need to get to that point. There is always that conversation, if it's free, kids aren't going to appreciate it. I truly believe that a society, but more in particular, individuals who want to get education will appreciate it. Should it be completely free? That's a conversation that's being had at the national level. Maybe there should be some skin in the game as we talk about it, where they pay a smaller portion. But I will tell you, there's one thing that's important. We have to reduce the costs, whether it's almost free or close to as free as possible, to make it as easy as possible for young adults to be able to get through to higher education.
Well, and from my perspective as an educator, you know, what I oftentimes see is that students are enormously grateful for the opportunity. They see their parents breaking their backs, trying to put a roof over their head, food on the table, and to hopefully advance them from an educational standpoint. There is tremendous appreciation for that. So I do think it's very simplistic to say that people don't appreciate that opportunity when most of the evidence just points completely to the contrary. California also has about 2.1 million community college students and roughly, well, I believe it's 114 community colleges. What role should our community colleges play in California's higher education system?
There is a tremendous role that they can and should and will continue to play. You just cited some of the statistics that the community colleges have. Keep in mind that there are more kids that are having to go to community college because they can't afford to go into a four-year, but want to earn their college degree. But what we've got to do is we got to make it easier for them to make a transition from community college to whether it's Cal State or the UC system. We have to make it easier for them to be able to get an education. I was one of the principal co-authors with Assemblymember Santiago that the governor signed that bill, and it was put into law that's going to start next year where they're going to have one free year of community college for kids. We have to figure out ways to make it much, much easier. And again, going back to your earlier question with regard to making it free, maybe another option is some kind of public service that they give back in exchange for helping reduce the cost, where they go into an area where there's a greater need, where maybe they go back to teach in an area where it's an underserved or underpopulated communities.
Well, we also know from a taxpayer standpoint, investing in education pays tremendous dividends. If we have a young person who goes to work out of high school and they're earning $40,000 a year, their contribution to the tax base is significantly less than if they receive an education, become a professional, earn $80,000, $100,000, $200,000 a year.
I totally agree, because by investing in the middle class and investing in higher education, you are investing in the future of the state of California. You hit the nail on the head. Individuals that are making more money and economically more viable with regard to making a living, they're going to buy more TVs, they're going to go out to dinner more, they're going to go on vacation, they're going to spend more money. Therefore, they're going to provide more tax base to the state of California. And what is that going to in turn do? Better public safety, more police officers, better roads. We're going to have the ability to have more money going into our tax system. People are going to be able to hopefully afford to be able to buy homes. More money is going to go back into our K through 12. It is only going to benefit the state. By having a robust, educated workforce in the middle class, it benefits the state of California.
I certainly agree with that. And when people have more disposable income, certainly we live in a society that's not shy about helping them dispose of it.
Yeah, no, people like to want to and like to spend their money. And we need to make sure a lot of people have that opportunity to live the American dream, be able to have an education, and do better than their parents did.
Well, according to the National Institutes for Early Education Research, 90% of five-year-olds attend a public kindergarten, but only half of California's four-year-olds and only 21% of three-year-olds are enrolled in either a public preschool or federally funded Head Start. California families, especially in the middle class, are struggling to find anything affordable because many preschool tuitions are actually more than tuition is at the University of California. Although most preschool programs are targeted at poor kids, an estimated 170,000 eligible children can't go because there simply aren't enough spots for them. As a result, only 13% of low-income children are in high-quality programs. So given what we know about the critical nature of early childhood education and its role in cognitive development and future success, how do we ensure that these children are able to enroll in and attend programs that are so vital to their long-term success?
As you said, early childhood education is absolutely important because it's the building blocks and the foundation for children to be successful in life, not only from K through 12, but through adulthood. The more money we put into early investment, just like preventive care and health care, the better we are going to be as a society. If you look at what's happened in the legislature, the Women's Caucus, both in the Senate and the Assembly, have made that their priority. And every single bill that has gone through the legislature, I have been very supportive to make sure that we achieve that goal, but more importantly, that we make that a priority. And we as a caucus, the Democrats that is, have made it a priority for childhood development, made it a priority as a what we want to make sure happens as a in the budget, and made that a priority of what we feel is important for us as legislature, as Democrats in the state of California.
I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Perspectives on KX 93.5 FM. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest this week is state senator and candidate for California's lieutenant governorship, Dr. Ed Hernandez. Education drives the economy and innovation. California's economy trails only those of China, Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom in sheer size. Where do you see the next great growth areas for job opportunities and innovation in our economy?
You know, I think the biggest growth sectors in the state of California has to be in high tech. It has to be in the green job space. But I'll tell you, there's another sector that really we should be concentrating on growing, which will solve two things. It'll solve, number one, those middle class working jobs I was talking about earlier, but solving the housing crisis. If you think about the last recession we had in the state of California, prior to that, we had a lot of individuals that were in the building trades. As soon as the recession hit, a lot of those individuals, because there was less building of homes and construction work, they left the state of California. They left, you know, they got out of it. They went into another trade. They went back to school, and they relearned. We're having a housing crisis right now, but I can tell you we don't have enough skilled workers, enough electricians, enough carpenters, enough individuals in the trades to be able to build the infrastructure to build more housing units in the state of California. As I go back to a statement I made earlier, yes, college is important, but also there's some trade tech. You're doing things with the building trades to get kids to get out to become, you know, a journeyman in plumbing and electricity. They make six figures, but we need that kind of skilled workforce. So yes, green tech is very important. You know, a lot of the arts as well as the sciences. But I really believe we need to start looking at rebuilding our workforce, especially within the building trades.
A person cannot even be an auto mechanic without understanding computers because of all the diagnostic systems on our cars today. So something that we used to look at and many people derisively would call, you know, grease monkeys, mm-hmm. requires a very strong technological background in order to function at an appropriate professional level. Going back to the notion of green technologies, how much of a role do you see green technologies such as wind, solar, and zero emissions vehicles playing in California's employment and economic future?
Well, if you look at what we have done in the legislature over the last 1, 2, 5, 10 years, going back to AB 32, to SB 32, to SB 100, the De Leon bill, which wants to get us to 100% renewable energy in the future, that has been the priority and the values of what we in California want to achieve. And we want to get to the point where we are not going to be dependent on fossil fuels, because we all know what that does, number one, to the environment, what it does to the greenhouse gas emissions, more importantly, what it could do if there's an oil spill out in our pristine oceans. And that's what we are getting to. And the challenges that we're going to have is once we have that electrical grid, once we have the solar panels, then how do we get that so that we can translate that into getting that energy into the various modes of transportation? The other thing that we've done in the legislature is to prioritize how we're going to get cars off the road onto whether it's light rail or whether it's high-speed rail to be able to reduce the amount of traffic we have. And we all know how it is to drive here in the Southern California or even in the Bay Area, how much traffic it is. So I think what we really need to do is prioritize and move in to someday having 100% renewable energy as the means to be able to power our houses, energy, lights, and transportation.
And it's not to suggest that we're not struggling with how do we achieve that, but at least there's recognition that this is the goal and that we need to move towards it. I had a great aunt in the 1970s who came out to visit her brother in Malibu. She never knew that there were mountains around Los Angeles because the air quality was so horrific. So we're at least trending in the right direction. Obviously a long way to go, especially in terms of traffic, but at least we're putting cleaner vehicles on the road, and we recognize that it's going to take some time, but you know, as they say, the old proverb, you know, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And it appears that's where we are. And there are certainly going to be missteps along the way. But at least we know that we've got this target in mind and we're moving towards it. Traditionally, inexpensive and abundant energy has been instrumental in driving our economy. In fact, in reflection, that's probably why we had such poor air quality or contributed to our poor air quality in the 70s. But in the spirit of deregulation and getting government off the backs of the American people, the administration in Washington, D.C. has proclaimed that the coastal waters of our nation should be open for offshore drilling. Given the magnificence of our coast and our beaches, as well as the history of smog and pollution in our state, is offshore drilling desirable or appropriate for California?
Not as far as I'm concerned. And even though the federal government is trying to increase the number of offshore drilling, I would be adamantly opposed. As I mentioned earlier, the values of the state legislature and here in California is we want to move away from fossil fuels. Can you imagine if we continue to do any type of offshore drilling? And we are here right now in a beautiful beach that I can just see out the window. Can you imagine if there is an oil spill, what it's going to do not only to the community, what it's going to do to the environment, and what it's going to do to the wildlife that's out here in the oceans? So no, I would be totally opposed to that, and I think we need to do everything we can to avoid any type of offshore drilling that this administration is trying to put upon the state of California.
And even if you're not as big of a fan of our marine life and air quality as so many of us are, even from a business standpoint, what would that do to our economies here along coastal California if we were to have a major spill? It would absolutely be devastating, and we might well never fully recover from that. In the 60s here in Laguna Beach, some of us with long-term memories in our community might remember there was a move to try and build a marina here in Laguna Beach. And it was pushed back against. And it was obviously there's no marina here now. Our coastal waters are the great gift that we have in Laguna Beach, and maintaining them should be paramount. Let's not be penny wise and dollar foolish.
I agree. I totally agree with you.
What is your response to those who would suggest that having cheap oil then is necessary for our economy and for our security?
You know, so we have abundant amount of oil. At one point, we were very dependent on foreign oil. Look what happened when OPEC and they increased the prices. And you can remember the long lines that we had back in, what is it, the 70s.
73, I think the big oil embargo was.
I can remember in high school the long lines into the gas stations. But we don't have to drill offshore because by drilling offshore, things will happen exactly what we just talked about, the environment, the wildlife, the economic impact that we can have on the state. We currently are having enough oil out within the state of California, and we're not having to truck it in, and we are one of the largest producers within the United States. Now, the key, though, is we have to make sure that we extract it properly, but more importantly, that we move towards not being dependent on oil and fossil fuels, and we work on legislation to get to the point where we can use renewable energy.
Well, then that segues perfectly into my next question, because by the end of 2016, we saw that India had installed 11 gigawatts of solar and 29 gigawatts of wind capacity, moving much closer to their goal of 100 gigawatts of solar and 75 gigawatts of wind power by 2022. In just a few short years, India has installed nearly as much solar capacity as the top three states in the U.S., California, New Jersey, and Massachusetts combined, making India now the fourth largest solar power country in the world. In 2016, China added more than 34 gigawatts of solar capacity, nearly 1.5 times the amount that the entire U.S. has installed in its entire history. What is California doing to reduce its dependence on fossil fuels? And perhaps you can speak to this as a state legislator, to reduce its dependence on fossil fuels, which are contributing to global warming and rising sea levels.
So as I mentioned earlier, with regard whether it's education, the environment, and assuming we're going to talk about healthcare, what has the priority of the California State Legislature, we and how we govern, and how we have been the leaders in the country? Granted, we're not hitting the marks like you had mentioned with regard to India or China, but our priority in this state is to move in that direction. Look at Senator De Leon's SB 100 to eventually get to 100% of renewable energy. You know, when you look at SB 350 to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, these are things that we have moved forward and made it a priority for us as a legislature. Look at what we've done as being a leader in climate. You know, our governor is now being the leader on the world stage, going to the Paris summit for with regard to the climate. The current president of the United States is not even willing to do it. So at least you know how the saying is, where California goes, the rest of the country goes. Let's just hope we get to the point where wherever California goes, the rest of the world goes.
A bit earlier, we discussed education and the importance of cultivating a well-educated population from pre-K through 12. Of California's 2.1 million community college students, roughly 1 in 7, that's nearly 300,000 people, have been or are homeless. The University of California and the California State University systems estimate that they have 54,000 of their students as housing insecure. When you combine those numbers, we're seeing over 350,000 people struggling with housing while pursuing their higher education. What can and should we be doing to help ensure that so many of our brightest and best have access to the ladder of success and can achieve their full potential and further enhance the greatness of California?
So let's talk about the issue at large and the problems we're having, number one, in society. Being a state senator, representing just under 1 million people, literally from the time I got elected to the assembly up until now, we're seeing a huge increase, period, number one, in the number of homelessness, the number of individuals that have food insecurities, kids that are going to school that can't even have enough to eat. There is becoming a societal problem where it's not just mental health issues, but substance abuse issues. Look at what we have done in the legislature. We're going to be putting on the ballot to be able to bring some money to be able to reduce the amount of homelessness that we have in the state of California. I've introduced bills in the legislature for food insecurity and are within our public school systems. It is sad that we're having more and more college students. It's difficult as it is that they have to not only work to get through school, but now have food insecurity, but are homeless as well. I don't know if you read that article in the LA Times not too long ago about that young individual who was an immigrant, who came to this country, who lives in literally a small mobile home, has to drive, but is a UC Berkeley student and is food insecurity and is now homeless. I mean, right. This is not the United States of America, and we have to redirect where our priorities, and we have to make sure that we address, number one, homelessness, that we have been doing so, mental health issues, and substance abuse issues as well.
It really is remarkable, and that actually was an article that I had seen recently, and it just, you know, I think of anybody who understands and respects how hard people are working mm-hmm. to try and obtain an education to better themselves in life. I think anybody who read that article would want to make sure that we're doing something to make sure that these young people, and it's not just young people, we see people returning to education because they want to take that next step professionally or personally. You know, we need to make sure that they have the tools, the means, and the methods by which they can succeed and contribute further to our economy. Speaking of housing insecurity, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development estimates that California has a homeless population of 135,000 people. Driving between Orange County and LA, it would seem that we actually have much more than that. Additionally, in Los Angeles alone, we have 600,000 people that are considered severely rent burdened. And across our state, countless hardworking people are struggling with the cost of housing. How should we approach this seemingly intractable problem of reducing homelessness and providing affordable housing for working families?
You know, it's a multi-pronged problem that we're having. I personally feel that a lot of the homelessness is due to a lot of substance abuse and mental health issues that obviously we have to deal with from a public policy perspective. But I think if you look at the housing issue, the biggest problem we have is, bottom line, it's pure economics. We don't have enough housing starts or housing units. And it's simple. It's supply and demand. You have more people in the state that we have units available to purchase, so the cost of the housing goes up. As the cost of the housing goes up, the rentals go up too, because you have fewer rental units available. Now, going back to an earlier comment I made, if we now invest in community college, and if we invest in the building trades, and we invest in getting more tradesmen to get out there, we're now going to have the workforce. But let me also tell you what we've done in the state of California. And again, this is, I think, still just the tip of the iceberg, but at least this is a start. Last legislative session, we put across to the governor and got signed into law three fairly significant bills. One that's going to put a bond on for the voters to be able to have money available to build more affordable housing, the Bell Bill. The other one was the Atkins Bill, which was an assessment on real estate transactions, again, to go into affordable housing. You know, and then the other one was the Wiener Bill, which I think hits to the heart of trying to make sure that we can reduce the amount of red tape when it comes to building housing. Matter of fact, just this year, he introduced another bill which didn't get out through the legislature. It was stalled in the assembly, which would allow housing to be built much more easily along corridor transits so we can reduce the amount of people to get them off the freeways. So we have to prioritize, but the bottom line is we have to look at how we're going to incentivize more construction, more building of units. And there's another problem that we're starting to have, too, especially in the rental market. You're seeing a lot of problems with units going up in price because, you know, individuals that are going in, they're buying the houses, and there's a lot of gentrification in those communities, which I'm saying it's a good thing, or it could also be a bad thing, because now you're forcing out poor people to be able to afford. So I think to solve this problem is reducing the number of red tape that we have to build the number of houses, to increase the number of individuals that are in the building trades to be able to build these homes, but more importantly, have more incentives to be able to get more housing built here in the state of California.
This is a problem that we have to look at holistically. None of these things occur in a vacuum or individually, and in order to resolve these problems, we have to look at not just educating, training people. We have to make sure that we're looking at it from a transportation perspective so people can get to work more easily, not spend as much of their time on the road. It helps our communities in so many different ways. I want to transition to the issue of healthcare, because healthcare is on the minds of so many people and is almost, it seems, always on the minds of the American people. Healthcare expenses are a significant factor contributing to personal bankruptcies here in the United States. A Harvard study published in 2009, and I apologize, that was the most recent study that I could find, estimated that medically related expenses are responsible for 57.1% of U.S. bankruptcies, so more than half. You would think that that number should violate California's state obscenity laws. But more recent official statistics from the U.S. courts indicate that medical-related bankruptcies are even higher than that. How do we expand access to quality, affordable health care, reduce overall costs, and address the health care provider shortage throughout California?
So let's first talk about what California has done right. We have been the leader of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which I believe is the most transformative piece of healthcare law that has been passed in this country, has ever seen since the Johnson administration, from Medicare to the implementation of the Medicaid program that we have in the United States. What we've done, we've signed up more people. We've reduced the number of uninsured by half. We are now at 6.7% uninsured in the state of California. We have a robust Medi-Cal system that's providing care to individuals, and we are trying to control healthcare costs. The other thing that we've done to answer your question is by having the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, as opposed to the prior healthcare system that we had, is we have now in law, which I authored and which are obviously the consumer protections, is that there's maximum out-of-pocket expenses that patients now have to pay, whether it's a single or it's a family. So no one, as long as they have coverage, whether it's through Cover California or especially through Medi-Cal, will never have to deal with any kind of bankruptcies. This is now what we've done. Now, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that this healthcare system is under attack by the federal government and this president to try to change back to the days of exactly what you've had, what you were talking about. And that's why I am fighting so hard to make sure that we not only be successful with the Affordable Care Act, but we get to the point where we have universal health coverage. Now, to answer your other part of your question with regard to access, in the state of California, and I would venture to say across the entire country, we have a huge shortage of primary care providers that don't go to two areas in various communities. They don't go to predominantly rural, like the Central Valley, and poor inner city communities. And guess where those communities are? Those are communities that are predominantly African American and Latino and communities of color. And by having that shortage, those are the communities that have the highest number and the highest incidences of chronic disease, and those are the highest cost drivers that we have in our healthcare system. I have been fighting my entire legislative career to be able to make sure that we get access to care in the most vulnerable communities. But there's another thing that we have to do that very few people ever want to talk about, that if we're really going to change the healthcare system, is we have to have a conversation about controlling healthcare costs. And I will tell you, one of the biggest cost drivers that we have in this country is the cost of pharmaceutical drugs. And last year, I got signed into law one of the most transformative bills that deals with controlling healthcare costs, especially with the prescription drugs, that is now becoming a model for the rest of the country when Governor Brown signed my SB 17, that will allow us to have true transparency in our drug industry and prescription drugs that we have in the state of California.
I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Perspectives on KX93.5 FM. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest this week is State Senator and candidate for California's Lieutenant Governorship, Dr. Ed Hernandez. Democrats have been accused by Donald Trump and congressional Republicans of wanting a nation without borders, open to anyone and to any threat that may want to enter our country to destroy America. I find that accusation not only absurd, but I find it vulgar. Under your leadership, what would you like to see done to guarantee safe and secure borders? And what would a responsible and humane policy regarding immigration and the treatment of refugees look like?
So we are a country of immigrants. You talked about your family earlier on in this show. I talked about my roots, my grandparents who came to this country from Mexico. And this is the land of opportunity. And people come to this country. They come to this country to live the American dream. Now, we can have a conversation about legal entry. We can have a conversation about how we process them. But what I'm really, really appalled at is how this president is trying to separate families. Granted, he went back and he's now trying to reunite them, but using children as political pawns to be able to get what he wants, to possibly build the wall, or to use immigrants as a wedge in the United States of America, which I think it's completely appalling. I think what has to be done is we have to have some kind of national immigration reform, and there needs to be some real conversation. And as a state legislator, I've always lobbied on behalf of that. As a lieutenant governor, if I become one, I will be an outspoken advocate to make sure that that happens. But what we have to do is we have to be fair. We have to make sure that anybody that comes to this country from any kind of, whether it's war-torn or coming for asylum, that we are able to process these individuals, but to be able to make it such that if somebody wants to enter this country, that we need to find a path for citizenship in the United States of America.
Well, and speaking of public safety, another aspect of public safety is gun violence. How do we provide learning environments for students that allow them to feel safe and secure while respecting the rights of law-abiding citizens to bear arms?
So let's again talk about what we've done in California. We have some of the most restrictive gun laws. Now, I believe people should still have the right to bear arms, but I don't believe that we should be allowing, you know, assault rifles, AR-15s, or the ability to have high-capacity magazines to be able to kill at whim and, you know, deal with these mass shootings that you've been able to see, whether it's in Las Vegas or all these schools. The other thing that I find really frustrating and upsetting is, you know, when the president or when you would think about certain legislators that would talk about, you know, teaching kids to throw rocks or, you know, arm teachers. I have a daughter that is a teacher, and when we brought up that conversation, there was no way she'd ever want to carry an arm, and our teachers should never want to be allowed to be able to carry any kind of firearms. I think what we have to do is have a real conversation about gun control. We have to have laws to be able to restrict high-capacity magazines, you know, the bump stocks. But more importantly, we have to have a conversation and be willing to take on the NRA so that we can say, look, we need to make sure that our children are safe, our streets are safe. And you're looking at what's happening in this country, especially with the young adults that are traveling, they're going to Washington, D.C. There is a movement, and people are angry of the violence that's occurring in this country about guns.
Well, and you mentioned certainly the mass shooting that we saw in Las Vegas not too long ago. This is not just an issue of safety for our students, but for everyone to be able to attend an event, to walk down the street, and to feel safe and secure in our communities. We're just about out of time, but there was something that's been on my mind, and I really wanted to ask this question of you. Because of California's top two finishers in the primary moving on to the general election, your opponent in this general election is going to be another Democrat, Eleni Kounalakis. Presumably, the differences between you and your Democratic opponent are not as substantial as they would be if you were running for lieutenant governor against a Republican. How does that affect your campaign going into the general election?
Well, there are differences, even though we are Democrats and we agree on very similar values and issues. I don't think there's a lot of difference in what we agree on. But what is difference is the experience. The fact that I have been an elected official going on 12 years. I was elected in the legislature right at the time when we had the Great Recession. I know what it's like to make tough decisions, to make cuts that were horrific that I did not want to take and make, and votes that I had to make, as opposed to now when we're in the best economic position that we are. We're the fifth largest economy in the world. We have had an on-time budget 7 times. I've been through numerous budgets where I've been able to, you know, vote on budgets, speak on the issue, but more important now, fight to find out how we're going to get excess money now into our public school systems, into our healthcare system. But here's the other thing too, the other advantage and the other difference is I've had the experience to run and carry large, major pieces of legislation that have impacted people in the state of California. I was the author to change the smoking age from 18 to 21. I authored all of the healthcare bills that we now have in the state of California, whether it's, you know, the 10 essential health benefits, whether it's all the consumer protections that we're talking about that you talked about earlier that doesn't allow anybody to go into bankruptcy anymore. I was the author that took on the pharmaceutical drug industry and brought in over $1 billion of federal money into our Medicaid system. And that money, a lot of that money is now used for our disabled community, which was suffering because of the recessionary period. So I think there's a clear difference. You are going to elect somebody that has experience running government, but more importantly, understanding how government runs, as opposed to somebody who doesn't have that experience. We may have similar values with regard to being a Democrat, But the biggest difference is the experience that I would bring and the trust that the voters of the state of California would have with me.
How will you work to ensure then that Republicans and independent voters are comfortable enough to support you in your effort to represent them?
Well, I mean, we have an open primary. We're such that now there's two Democrats. The whole reason was it was put on the ballot so that we can have more of a moderation. Well, here's the other thing that makes me unique as well. And I'm not saying that of my opponent because she's also a business person. But the fact that I own and run a private practice, have been in business for going on 31 years. But here is another big stark difference. Is when I graduated from optometry school in 1986 and decided to open up my practice, a business, in the community that I grew up in, I had no money whatsoever. My parents, who have very little, took a second on their home and lent me everything that they ever had. I paid them back, but I took a risk on their money and opened up a business and was successful. I have hired people over the years. I've owned commercial property where, you know, I pay my taxes. I know what it is to be the last person to get paid. So I have the business experience and understand the dynamics of not only being in business, but more importantly, of being in government and how government runs. So I have all the skills that's necessary to be the next lieutenant governor for the state of California.
Where can our listeners go to learn more about you?
You can go to our website. It's Ed Hernandez, EDHERNANDEZ, the number 4, CA.com. Come visit our website, and you can look at all the policy issues that I believe in. You can see all the endorsements I've had since I've been running for this position. And I'd be honored for you to come and take a look at the website.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for that. I just want to thank our audience for joining us today. You've been listening to Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson on KX93.5 FM. My guest this week has been California State Senator Dr. Ed Hernandez, candidate for California's lieutenant governorship. Please join Perspectives again next week. Until then, take care, everybody.
See, my dear, I like my toast done on one side. You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue, a walking cane here at my side. some bad kid to make a man. It takes more than a license for a gun. Confront your enemies, avoid them when you can. A gentleman will walk but never run. The manners make of manners, someone say. He's a hero of the day. It takes a man to suffer ignorance and smile. Be yourself, no matter what they say. 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 Spinning wheel, like a snowball down a mountain, or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's burning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Never shone like a door that keeps revolving in a half forgotten dream. Are the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of his face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Jangle in your head. Why does summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your head? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragment of this song. Half remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? Was over, were you suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the color of her hair, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever spinning reel, as the images unwind, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragment of this song. Half remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, were you suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the color of her hair, like a circle in
and spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever spinning reel, as the images unwind, like the circles that you find, and the windmills of your mind. This time where she's gone, I wonder if she's gonna stay. No sunshine when she's gone, this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away, ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. No sunshine when she's gone. She's always gone too long. Every time she goes
away.